Welcome to the NOLA Drinks Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink and food in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, friends. Thanks for listening to the NOLA Drinks Show this week. As always, hey, if you're listening on the radio, happy Monday. If you're listening to the podcast, happy day, whatever day it is for you. Yep, there you go. A little bit of news here on the show. Well, let's start here. I'm going to tell you what today's show is all about. We are going to be joined by Todd Price, who is the lead dining writer for the Times-Picayune newspaper and their online presence, NOLA.com. And we're over there, one of our favorite spots, Two Jags, right there on Decatur Street in the French Quarter across from the French Market. And we chat with Todd a bit about, you know, the dining scene here around New Orleans, some things that he's excited about, things to look for. We're joined in one of the segments by the new executive chef there at Two Jags, Thomas Roby. And Thomas, an interesting fellow, was a sous chef at Commander's Palace for well over 20 years before taking the reins a handful of months ago at Two Jags. So he joins us, brings us some really delicious food, by the way, to munch on. So yeah, that's what we do. And Todd sticks around for another shot with NOLA Drinks. We talk a little bit more about what he's excited about around the dining scene here in New Orleans. Friends, next week's show, we are continuing on with our French Quarter Fest series, of which you know I love it. I'm super excited about it because we get to talk to all kinds of great musicians that participate in French Quarter Fest coming up here in April. And we tape these interviews at Louisiana Music Factory, a very, very, very fine record store there, 421 Frenchman Street. And it's going to be an ongoing thing. We're going to continue it after French Quarter Fest is over because they've got other events like Satchmo Fest that come up in the summer and things like that. So this is going to be a continuing thing. We probably won't do them quite as often after the festival is over until we sort of ramp up again for Satchmo Fest and then French Quarter Fest next year and so on. But we got our next installment, our third, I believe, that's going to be coming up next week on next week's show, joined by Corey Henry, who is a fabulous trombonist, leader of Corey Henry and the Treme Funktet. Grew up around all kinds of music, had a grandfather that played for Preservation Hall. He himself played with his uncle, Benny, in the Treme Brass Band. Really cool guy. Grew up in the Treme, of course, and just really fun to have on the show. And we're joined also during that interview, by Sam Kraft. And Sam is one of the members of the really cool band Sweet Crude, and they're sort of an indie pop with a pretty good New Orleans influence band, bunch of kids. But one of the cool things they do is that they do stuff both in English and in French. So they're kind of honoring the Francophile tradition, the Cajun French tradition that we have, as it relates to South Louisiana, and integrating that into their music, but with more of an indie pop kind of sensibility as far as the music itself goes. And we talk with them about both Corey and Sam about their music, where you can catch them, what it's like participating in the festival. We talk a little bit about food and drink, as we always do on the show. So that'll be next week's show, something to look forward to there. And since we're talking about the show, let's talk about the show. If you're listening on the radio, you're listening here on Monday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. WGSO, the station on which we are, is going to also be airing the replay of this particular show, or every Monday show, will be replayed Friday evenings from 7 to 8 p.m. I have a lot of people that ask me, why do you do the show on Monday night? I actually do the show on Monday evenings because of the fact that a lot of folks that listen to this show are in the service industry, and that's a good evening. You know, they're often are off because their restaurants are closed, or, you know, staff on Monday evenings are generally not quite as, not so many people working in a particular shift and things like that. So that was really by design as to why I wanted to do the show on Monday nights. But, you know, Monday Night Football goes on, some other things. You know, Monday nights may not be the best way for you to listen to it. So for those, especially not in the service industry, Friday nights at 7 p.m. is an opportunity for you to catch the show. But of course, I always encourage people to get the podcast. Why? Because you can listen to it when you want to. But it allows you to catch our extended podcast-only content that we call Another Shot with NOLA Drinks. Like, for example, Todd here from the Times-Picayune and NOLA.com is going to stick around and hang out with us. We do that with our French Quarter Fest series. We pretty much do that with every show. So you get to get a little further into the weeds with us on the podcast. But whatever works for you, you can find the podcast on your favorite platform. You can find it at NOLADrinks.com. Yeah, easy way to do that. And you can get it from your favorite platform, you know, Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, blah, 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 all those. And just go to NOLADrinks.com. That's the easiest way to do it. But you can look for NOLA Drinks on your favorite podcast platform, and it's going to come up too. One other note on the show here is that we got a new logo coming out here in the coming days pretty soon. We're rolling out a little bit of a new image on the show. We think it's a little bit more reflective of what the show is about. As you may know, our tagline has kind of evolved, and it is now exploring the world of drink, food, and culture in New Orleans and beyond. We kind of added that bit about culture because if you listen to the show, you know we talk about a lot more things than just drink and food. Certainly, that's a big part of the culture here in this part of the world. But we talk about, you know, we're doing the French Quarter Fest series thing, and a lot of that emphasizes music. So we thought that it was a little more reflective of the show. And we decided, well, kind of the brand needed to change with it a little bit. Not that this is too exciting for you out there, I'm sure, but we're pretty excited about here. Got a new logo coming out there. And again, this is what we do on the show, exploring the world of drink, food, and culture in New Orleans and beyond, friends. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a little break here on the program, and then we're going to be heading over to Two Jags for our featured interview with Todd Price from NOLA.com and the Times-Picayune. Come on back. We're at night war hunters, and we don't bow down on nobody's ground. Hey friends, Brian Diaz here with the NOLA Drink Show. Agave Week is back with its new headquarters at the Ace Hotel in downtown New Orleans. Week-long events kick off Sunday, March 10th with tequila and mezcal tastings, seminars, panel discussions, and one-of-a-kind parties. Visit NOLAAgaveWeek.com for tickets and info. The Grand Tasting is the third annual Top Taco with unlimited gourmet tacos and cocktails from some of the best restaurants in the city. It's happening at Waldenburg Park Thursday, March 14th from 7 to 10 p.m. For tickets and info, visit TopTacoNOLA.com.
Every afternoon when I wake up, I say a little prayer and drink up, and thank the Lord for driving me home once more. There's an open Bible on the table and an empty bottle on the floor. Last night I thought I died and went to Whiskey Hill.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks, friends, for listening in this week. As always, we are at one of our very favorite places, the second oldest restaurant in New Orleans, Two Jags Restaurant, right here on Decatur in the French Quarter. And I am pleased to be joined by my guest, Mr. Todd Price, lead dining writer for the Times-Picayune and NOLA.com. Todd, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure because I've been at this for a little while, but this is the first time that I've had the good fortune of having you on.
Well, let's do it more often.
Let's do it more often. That's
there
a big
we go.
Well, let me
well, let me do the first one first.
Let me not promise.
I'm never doing this again.
I've had people say that. So, you know, you might just say, hey, yeah, that guy, what a hack. But it's great having you on, Todd, and we're here at Two Jags, as I noted. Tell us a little bit. So you've been writing for the Picayune and NOLA.com, I should probably say, for a good number of years. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how did you get involved with this?
Yeah, I mean, food writing in general?
Yeah,
so,
sure.
Well, we moved here in 2004 to New Orleans.
Where are you from originally, Todd?
Originally Oklahoma, Tulsa, Oklahoma,
okay.
But I haven't lived there since high school. Lived a lot of places in between. So we actually were in D.C. right before we got here. Came down from my wife's job, and I was sort of looking for a change and started freelancing, first for Gambit, doing some food writing for them, and then I was the food critic at Gambit. I replaced Sarah Rowan.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Did that for 6 months to the day until Katrina hit. The final review was Gautreaux's and a Sunday edition that never got distributed.
Oh, no. Okay.
But when I got back, worked for New Orleans Magazine for a while, Offbeat, and then about 10 years for the Picayune. Five as a freelancer, covering drinks exclusively, more or less, and then five on staff full-time, focus more on restaurants. But still, I do the bar guide, the mm-hmm. bar picks,
yeah.
Do drinks coverage as well.
Do you have a journalism background, Todd?
I don't. I have an academic background.
Okay.
I have a doctorate in Spanish and from University of Virginia. And so for a while I was freelancing, I was a lecturer at Tulane. So I was teaching Spanish language, grammar, and then that was pretty flexible and let me freelance. And so I did guidebooks, Agat, whatever came along. It worked out pretty well, but I'm happy to actually have a full-time job writing because there aren't that many of them.
There are not, especially now these days, right?
That's right. Exactly. We're all lucky when we got them, when we know it. So.
That's pretty cool. So when you got involved in doing this, was it you just had a passion for food and drink? And
yeah, I mean, all my life. I mean, I came from Oklahoma where there wasn't great food. It's better now. There's good beer now, finally.
Okay,
good beer,
right,
finally. but certainly when I got a chance to travel and went to school in St. Louis and got exposed to Vietnamese food and a lot of different things. And I traveled a lot, lived in Spain, lived in France.
Okay.
So food was kind of my way of getting to know places, getting to know the world. And it's always just been something I've loved. So
did you kind of just start doing like side gigs and doing some freelance writing when you were still teaching on the food and drink thing?
As soon as I got to town in New Orleans, I did them both at the same time.
Okay.
But as soon as I got to New Orleans, I was really naive and I didn't realize everybody wanted to be a food writer. I just say, hey, I like food. I want to write. That works.
I have decent grammar.
Yeah. And by an incredible stroke of luck, the second person I met in town was Pablo Johnson, who's a great local food writer. Who introduced me to the editor of the Gambit, and I signed on into the absolute most thankless job they had, which was their restaurant guide, where you just call 50 restaurants and ask them for the hours, and they yell at you because you called them 3 months ago, and they're really tired of this.
Right.
And I put up with that, and they said, "Well, why don't you pitch us a story?" And it just kind of went from there. So
cool,
yeah,
very interesting. And so then, how did you transition into? So you started doing some freelance stuff for NOLA.com,
right.
And then you were writing the drink stuff,
right? Yeah, I mean, at that time, at that time when I came on as a freelancer. We were just looking for something for me to do that was, I mean, I was really into drinks and really into cocktails, and it made sense with so much going on. I mean, you think back, that was 10 years ago, roughly.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when NOLA Brewing was just started.
Oh, sure.
In fact, I wrote the first story about NOLA Brewing, which I'm not trying to be,
But
I remember, I mean, at the time, we had a Beta. It had been around a long time. We were way behind in craft beer. There were none others. And I remember meeting Kurt Coco, the founder, at his apartment in Uptown. And he had some swag already printed up, and he had some test beers in the refrigerator. He said,
Kurt's good with that, with the swag.
Yeah, and he's like, we're going to have a brewery. I'm like, writing it all down. I'm like, yeah, okay, sure. And, not really fully believing when I published this story that it was actually going to happen. And it did. And, Cure opened 10 years ago as well.
Yeah.
In fact, they're celebrating also their anniversary. So a lot happened in drinks in this city in the 10 years. And the 5 years I covered it exclusively were really busy. I mean, a lot of activity.
Well, let me ask you this question, because it's an interesting topic and kind of maybe a bit of a tangent here. But one of the conversations that we have on the show from time to time is, we have the so-called craft cocktail renaissance from roughly 2000 in other parts of the country and things. And then we were a little late in the game, as you said, with craft beer.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, on a Cure level sort of craft cocktail thing, sure. But then we've kind of always had that going on here in New Orleans, haven't we? It's kind of maybe the original craft cocktail city in a lot of ways. And I always find that line of, like a place like Cure, how do you feel? How does this fit into the landscape? And how did things change here a lot, or did they not change here so much? Did it kind of absorb? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think things didn't change here as much because we always had cocktails.
Yeah.
In a way, the rest of the country didn't. I mean, the rest of the country stopped drinking everything but vodka and tonic, practically. A martini was made with vodka, which, don't get me started.
The old Midori melon ball.
Yeah, exactly. And, people here still knew or enjoyed having their Sazerac before dinner. That was always, it's always been part of the culture here. I mean, we kept rye alive because we were the only place in America that still bought the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Thank goodness kept it. But, even with all that, there were some great old school bartenders, but there were still a lot of bad drinks in this town. There still are, like in any town. But, there wasn't as much variety. I mean, I remember in the early days, Chris Hanna, the great bartender at Arnaud's French 75, when he started, they could do a classic cocktail, and that's about it. And he was making a lot of ingredients that back then you couldn't buy, like orgeat and other things, and he'd make them at home and keep them under the bar and bring them out for good customers, because at that time Arnaud's wasn't supporting him. So, so we see this variety, we've caught up, and certainly there were just things that couldn't be made until a few years ago because the ingredients were lost.
The ingredients
were
not
available.
I mean,
there were cocktails that you might want to make them, but you can't fabricate some liqueur at home. So, certainly what's happened everywhere, if nothing else, because the products are better, people are paying more attention, that certainly changed the quality of drinks here. And there's a lot of factors, but I think the quality of the products.
Yeah.
You know, we can just get stuff we couldn't get 10 years ago.
Absolutely, right.
You
absolutely.
Know, either it's imported now or it was reproduced.
So. Right, exactly. That's a great set of points right there. And I think, do you find, too, now I'm hard-pressed to find a place that opens up these days that at least doesn't attempt, maybe not always do it well,
right.
but doesn't at least attempt to have a quality cocktail program.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true across the country. Yeah. I think, you know, having a decent cocktail list is just part of having a fine dining restaurant. And that's just taken for granted everywhere. So,
that makes a lot of sense.
Even in Tulsa, Oklahoma, I can get a good cocktail now, which I can tell you that wasn't the case growing up. Not that I could get drinks at a...
You know, I remember meeting some kids that were, this was a couple years ago at Tales and the Cocktail, and they had just opened up, I believe, what they were calling the first craft cocktail bar in Des Moines. And they were so excited
to
be here.
And
it's everywhere. Well, so, Todd, what are we seeing here a little bit on the restaurant front? I know we've had some bumpy times and a lot of, I mean, I think the numbers of overall, the raw number, net number has more or less remained the same since post-Katrina. But what are we seeing trend-wise? Do you think we've kind of hit a stabilization here with closures to a degree, or is it still as volatile as it was 2 to 3 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, I don't actually think it's terribly volatile. I mean, for me, the story since Katrina has not been how many restaurants have opened, although that's certainly a story, but what's been shocking is how few restaurants have closed.
Right.
And I think, you know, you never want any individual place to close, but it's not healthy for this city to have this many restaurants. I know every single place will tell you they're desperate for staff. And that affects quality if you can't get decent people working in the front and the back. But I still see people striking out. You know, you see more modest restaurants, which I think is good. You see places like Margie's Grill, which fabulous place. You know, it's a young couple. They both work for Donald Link restaurants, really well trained. And they, this little bitty spot on Broad, nothing fancy about it. Thrift store, like plates.
Yep.
But they're doing amazing sort of Southeast Asian inspired food. That's
Fusion
great to
with
me.
New
yeah,
Orleans,
exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think you'll see a little more of that, the kind of bootstrapping up. Not quite as big of a spot. But then again, you got places like Justine that Justin Devilliers just opened, which has got to be one of the grandest, most beautiful kind of showplace restaurants I've seen in this city. I mean, it's just, I mean, other than like the great Grand Dames that have been forever, like Brennan's and everything, but it's a huge, stunning location.
Do you think, because I've actually had, I know Justin a bit and he's been on the show before. I've actually not had a chance to go there yet. Mm-hmm. Do we think that some of the people that are taking on that challenge of opening up some of these larger places, though, somebody like Justin, with Belize and La Petite Grocery that he's established himself. So I think a lot of the new openings that I seem to be seeing, it's less people moving, and this is just my speculation, but less people say you were a sous chef in Chicago, you think New Orleans is sort of a magic place, if you build it, they will come. Whereas people, I think, that have a little more experience and wisdom are opening up a lot of places or come up in the kitchen here.
I think that's true. I mean, for every small kind of bootstrap place like Margie's Grill, you see these kind of growing restaurant groups. You see Donald Link having more places, Robert LeBlanc with Sylvain and Longway. Now he has this hotel that he's putting in, which kind of sounds like a restaurant with a few rooms attached.
Yeah, right.
I
mean, exactly.
I think the restaurant's kind of made. So we're certainly seeing, you know, in places like Creole Cuisine, which is a group that just keeps buying up established restaurants like Tommy's and Broussard. So we do see a growing number of restaurant groups that seem to, you know, it's kind of this mix.
That wherewithal.
Small to, and then a groups that seem to be growing.
So. And it seems like, and again, maybe some speculation on my part, Todd, but people, like we're talking about the couple that runs Margie's.
Yeah.
They came up through Link, like we talked about. And so have some understanding of the landscape here and maybe a little bit more, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but maybe a little bit more reality about what the landscape is here.
Yeah. I mean, I think still compared to other cities, you see very few outside chefs coming in. And until recently, I think you almost saw none, you know, except for people getting hired at a hotel or something like that. I think Nina Compton was one of the few examples.
Sean Joseph's at Kenton's springs to mind, for example.
Yep.
But there's not
Brad McDonald at Couvent. Yep. He was incredibly talented. I mean, he's from Mississippi. He's not that far. But but he was in London kind of making his name and moved back to the States and came here. But we still don't see a lot of that. We still see, I think that's right, a lot of homegrown talent, people who put in their years here. If they're not from here, they spent time in the trenches here. So
and get it. And I think exactly. That matters a lot.
Exactly.
Well, let's do this, Todd. Let's take a little break here, and we're going to come back and chat with you more. I think Chef Thomas is going to join us here too, Jags, in a segment or two, and put some food in our bellies. I'm not going to complain about that. Got a Sazerac in front of me. Not going to complain about that. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Come on back. C'est le bon temps brûlé. Brian Diaz here with the NOLA Drink Show. Yeah, from the city that shares a deep connection to bourbon and knows how to throw a party, comes the third annual New Orleans Bourbon Festival from March 20th through the 23rd. Discover over 150 bourbons and American whiskeys, as well as great food at the Grand Tasting. Check out more than 30 seminars led by industry luminaries, special distiller dinners, and much more. The event is brought to you by Beam Suntory, Four Roses, Brown Foreman, Uncle Nearest, Bourbon Plus, and the Hilton Riverside. More info and tickets at nobourbonfest.com. Hey friends, Brian Diaz here with the NOLA Drink Show. Agave Week is back with its new headquarters at the Ace Hotel in downtown New Orleans. Week-long events kick off Sunday, March 10th with tequila and mezcal tastings, seminars, panel discussions, and one-of-a-kind parties. Visit NOLAAgaveWeek.com for tickets and info. The Grand Tasting is the third annual Top Taco with unlimited gourmet tacos and cocktails from some of the best restaurants in the city. It's happening at Waldenburg Park Thursday, March 14th from 7 to 10 p.m. For tickets and info, visit TopTacoNOLA.com. Joe Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for tuning into the NOLA Drink Show this week, friends. As always, we are here at Two Jags Restaurant, the second oldest restaurant. Yeah, that's right. Established in 1856 here in the French Quarter on Decatur. I'm chatting with my guest, Todd Price, who is the lead dining writer at the Times-Picayune newspaper, as well as NOLA.com. And also now we're joined by another guest, Chef Thomas Roby, who is the relatively newly minted executive chef here.
Been about 7 wonderful months.
Yeah, man. Awesome. So how's it getting the keys to the car here at a place that's been around for this long?
Well,
I'm not doing the math.
It's such a beautiful old restaurant. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to take the experience that I have from working in New Orleans. I've been cooking in New Orleans a very long time and trying to keep the traditions here, the great old dishes that have made Two Jacks what the restaurant that it is, but then just put a spin on some new things and just try to bring in some new ideas, making things a little bit fresher, a little bit newer, just making food that we're proud of.
You've been doing some good stuff, man, since you've been here, because I've had the pleasure of eating here several times since you took over the kitchen. So a lot of nice, like little things. You were telling me this some months ago, just like working on the side dishes, right? Just in that kind of across the plate presentation.
Well, a lot of the original dishes when I got here were almost too complex. You know, we have a small range back there, and they would try to shove multi ingredients into one saute pan and execute it on the one plate, which just really wasn't getting it done. I said, let's streamline it. Let's do one great starch, one great protein, one great sauce, and then we can make some sides available if people would like to have other things. I've also been very fortunate to find some cooks that I've worked with in the past that have the same kind of thinking that I do on how things should be treated, how food should be seasoned, and we've been making the kitchen even stronger so that we can put out the product that we're going to be proud of.
Cool. Todd, what's your impression? Because you've been doing this for a while, so you've seen some changes in the kitchen here.
And I have to admit, I have not been in to eat since you've gotten here, so I need to get in soon.
But, well, please do.
Yeah. And I have to say, my favorite thing is actually to eat in the bar and get that boiled beef as a po' boy and the shrimp remoulade.
Yeah, the brisket po' boy.
Yeah, the brisket.
With the spicy remoulade.
There's no taking the brisket off the menu.
That's been on the menu since day one,
right?
So we're not screwing with that. And we're not screwing with the chicken bon fond, right? I mean,
it's not necessarily on the menu, but it's always available.
Yeah,
right. That's a little secret. We blew the lid on that one here. Not that it's going to cause a rush for the chicken bon fond, but take some as Mark says, your owner Mark Ladder, take some chicken, add some garlic, add a little more garlic,
and then we're trying to add a little love.
And add a little love.
There you go.
I like that. Well, Todd, when we look at a place like Two Jacks, because I think we know here in New Orleans that the we were talking about this in the previous segment with some of the grand dames and things like that. There's an important culture of consistency, I think. And then there's some, stuff that we're doing here that Thomas is doing that also kind of making some course corrections, audibling a little bit. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that? I mean, that's a fine line to walk.
Yeah, I mean, you look at what's happening in a lot of the older restaurants. I mean, there's some, like Commander's, which I know you know well.
Yeah, 23 years.
That's right. And Brennan's, which are kind of always, well, Brennan's now is really evolved. Commander's is always. You have places like Antoine's, which has barely changed, although they're about to make some changes. Arno's sort of has navigated the difference. But it must be tough, though, because I mean, there's expectations of you're going to give people an experience that looks to the past, but you also have to bring it into the present. I mean, I wonder how do you kind of look at that?
My biggest goal right now is to get my locals back. This used to be one of the most popular restaurants for locals in the quarter. Mm-hmm. Through one reason or another over the years, it may have fallen out in some people's eyes.
Yeah.
But Two Jacks is here.
Right.
We're ready for the locals to come back. We're ready to feed them the way that they want to be fed. We're ready to treat them they want to be treated.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, our visitors are so important as well, but it's seeing the same faces, week after week and shaking hands and talking to people and seeing how they like the changes.
Right.
I mean, we've already taken the menu in a couple different directions because, some things work, some things don't. But we're just trying to just really concentrate on making it fresh, making it, to order, serving something that we'd be proud to serve our friends or our family. Because really, that's what we are here in the back of the house. I only have 9 cooks on my schedule, so I'm very lucky to be able to put together a team of people that really want to be here and really get it. And I've been pulling people from some of the great restaurants in town because I've been around a minute and I know a few people. But
and are you finding people that are attracted to that, Thomas, and want to come here?
Well, there's all kinds of different work environments out there. We hear all these different nightmares. One of the training that I got at Commander's Palace was you treat your people well. And you educate them and you make it worth their while to stay, both financially and professionally.
Mm-hmm.
You can make a certain dollar wage at any restaurant in the quarter, but somebody that actually cares about you and cares about your involvement, with this new menu I'm coming up, I was going for March 1st, but then I remember that whole Mardi Gras thing. So hold off.
Look out.
About March 11th, we'll be rolling out our next menu. And now that the professional as our cook have come up, the skill level our cook has come up, so now it's time to bring the menu up even more and make better stuff that we want to do. But you include them in the choices, and you include them and get their feedback and see, what do they think? Because I'm not the guy that's going to be working sauté every night. Mm-hmm. So maybe the guy working sauté is like, hey, that dish takes up 3 pans. I mean, I got 8 burners. So, okay, well, let's talk about it together. So what can we do to make it different? What direction can we make it in? Could this be a cold salad on top instead of a warm sauté thing, Our pantry has so much storage space. So, hey, maybe we put all this stuff here. We keep this here. It's really just about organization and making it a pleasant place to work because, quite frankly, there's too many places to work. And I'm fully staffed right now, and I can't say I know another guy that's got a restaurant that is fully staffed. So I'm blessed. Yeah.
Well, and that's a great point because, Todd, you and I were talking about that before, and that kind of leads into the question I wanted to ask you, Todd, now, is that there are more spaces available than there are jobs, right, or people, excuse me. So what are you seeing as far as restaurants go, as far as trying to staff with talent, and then the trends towards working as like what Thomas just said, working on creating an environment and a culture where people want to stay? People can jump ship here pretty easily these days.
Yeah. No, I think you see people talking a lot about that because you can't offer more money I mean, there's a ceiling.
To a point.
To a point. Yeah, I mean, sure. Everybody says, oh, pay them more. Well, if you pay your staff more, then you got to charge more, and you can't be the first person to do that because then, you know, people say, oh, it's overpriced, and they go somewhere else. So there's this pressure on both sides, and you do see people saying, like, how can we make it more pleasant? Because obviously even the most pleasant kitchen is a really tough job and physical and demanding. So anything people can do to make it more pleasant, to give them a better experience. You know, I think about things like I was talking recently to Mason of Turkey and the Wolf. And, you know, he got hugely popular, got all this press. And he told me, I could open for dinner and make more money, but I got all this publicity. I can make all my money on lunch, and I can't offer a lot of money, but I can offer my people shorter hours, and they go home at 3, and that's what I can do. Mm-hmm. And people are thinking that way. Like, what can we offer? What kind of lifestyle? What atmosphere? What kind of training?
Culture.
You know? Yeah. The one thing you got to remember is it's the real estate and the new culinary students. We used to tap culinary students from all over the country, you know, when I started, you know, you get a one-bedroom apartment for, you know, $300, $400 a month.
Right.
Well, now these guys are graduating with these huge student loans.
Right.
And then you can't find anything that's decent or possibly safe for less than $800. The finances don't work, and they find another city to go to.
Yeah.
You know, you see less and less people coming in from out of town.
Yeah.
That's why we're working on taking care of the people that are in the city, bringing them up more. It's such a great thing that we got Noki up and running, and hopefully that's just going to get bigger and bigger. But you know, getting the starting level cook to get here and have them a place to live where they can, you know,
make a living wage.
Yeah, afford to go out and have a beer once in a while,
not have to live 40 miles outside of town.
It's real estate and transportation. You know, it pushes them further out, and we don't have a great public transportation system.
Exactly.
So, right. So that's
it's a great irony of the industry, is it not? When you start to price people out of the place where they need to actually work.
And you know, I've heard before as well. I mean, New Orleans is a great attraction, but food's gotten better all over the country. So, you know, you go to the culinary school and you're from Ohio, you can go back to Ohio and cook at a great restaurant now, which might not have been the case 20 years ago. You don't have to go to New Orleans necessarily to cook at a really great restaurant. So there's that as well. You know, I think that's changed the dynamic.
That's important.
I think that's probably why you're seeing fewer people. There's just more options.
Right.
Yep. Where you can go to Nashville, you can go to Memphis. They've all got things going on. So
let's do this, you guys. Do me a favor. 30 seconds. Tell people what we got right here.
All right, these are just two new dishes that we put on the menu. Great. This is a house cured pork belly. It's just a great tender piece of pork belly on some artisan grits, little roasted chili salad, and it's an orange horseradish gastrique. Of course, we're known for the grasshopper. We invented it here. Mm-hmm. This is a grasshopper panna cotta. We've piped it with a little chocolate mousse, and my favorite is little Andy's mints.
Very nice.
Yeah, I got to keep the office girls out of those. alone. So these are just things that, like the panna cotta is a great thing. It's representative of the restaurant, but yet it's a new twist.
Right.
And it's got some flair to it. It's got some finesse, you know. So it's just showing that what's possible when you mix the new and the old.
There you go. 100-year anniversary of the grasshopper just 3 months ago or so. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Come on back.
Oyster rake scraping down Grand Isle.
Les Le Bon Temps Brûlé. Brian Diaz here with the NOLA Drink Show. Yeah, from the city that shares a deep connection to bourbon and knows how to throw a party, comes the third annual New Orleans Bourbon Festival from March 20th through the 23rd. Discover over 150 bourbons and American whiskeys, as well as great food at the Grand Tasting. Check out more than 30 seminars led by industry luminaries, special distiller dinners, and much more. The event is brought to you by Beam Suntory, Four Roses, Brown Foreman, Uncle Nearest, Bourbon Plus, and the Hilton Riverside. More info and tickets at nobourbonfest.com. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with the WTSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land wherever you may be. Yep, we're here at Two Jags and one of our favorite spots. And Todd, man, we just crushed some pork belly.
Oh, my goodness. That was good. That was really good. He's doing good things here.
He's doing some really good things here.
I'm looking forward to getting in and trying his menu once he gets up.
It's pretty exciting what's going on here and some really cool things. Since we were kind of touching on this before, Todd, talking about, you know, changes. So we're talking about places like Two Jags. It's been around since 1856. And we mentioned in the previous segment talking about Antoine's, for example, having a new executive chef coming.
Right. First
on
one
board.
In 20 years, I think.
25, I think. Right. Regua was there for about that long. I mean, he was there for
47. He's been 40 years as an employee. Plus, but I think 20 something.
Yeah, yeah, right around that, that mark. Yeah. And that is, and we kind of talked about this a little bit, but that's a fine line to walk, man. Right. I mean, Antoine's in particular is something, and even kind of here like Two Jags, where we like our consistency. How do you see that landscape kind of playing out? We have a lot of new people coming in, opening things. Mm-hmm. Some things work, some things don't work, and then we have this backbone, I think, of things that are kind of here.
Mm-hmm.
How does that make you feel? I mean, when you report on something like this, that's a seismic shift in a place like Antoine's.
It is, yeah. I mean, and particularly when they start talking about doing some new things, anything new at Antoine's kind of makes people
it's
fearful.
Scary.
Although it does sound like they're doing the kind of new things that make sense. Reintroducing dishes that used to be there, doing special menus where they sort of do an historic menu, something they didn't used to do. But on the other hand, they're all businesses. You know, I think we too often, those of us who are just the diners, we forget they got to make money. They got to be businesses. They got to run efficiently. And so there's a lot of importance in making sure the ship is as tight as it can be.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like a lot of that is what they're trying to do at Antoine's as well. Just kind of upgrading equipment, being more modern in that way, not changing the food, but taking advantage of the weight.
Spreadsheets,
right? Spreadsheets. And, you know, better equipment in the kitchen, you know, that's just speeds up the process and will help people out.
Yeah, these are things that people shouldn't be scared of, right?
Right. I don't think so. I have confidence. I mean, I have a lot of hope that, you know, it could be a really interesting era for Antoine's. Mm-hmm. So,
How do you feel about the diner here, Todd, these days? Because we've talked a little bit about this previously in the first segment. Some of the volatility mm-hmm. and things like that. And we have, of course, people that go 5 times a year to Galatoire's or whatever it is that they do.
Right.
Do you see any trends changing in the makeup of the diner themselves here? We have a lot of new people in town. So does that change things?
Boy, I mean, it is hard to get a read on that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think we always in New Orleans, unlike a lot of cities, have restaurants that last a really long time. You know, everybody has their long-running restaurants, but we have so many places that have been around.
This 10, is not churn and
15,
burn, right?
25. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Places close. Some of them don't make it. There's always a lot of factors involved. But I still think places stick around here in a way they don't in other cities. And that's got to be because they've got regular customers. I mean, unless you're in Tourist Central and, you know, 2 feet from the convention center.
Sure, sure.
You don't stick around unless you have regulars who come in again and again. I do think, too, I mean, this city, more than most, is obsessed with food. And it's hard to know how much people come in from outside have changed it, because, I mean, it's kind of a new phenomenon. But it sure seems pretty clear that people coming in are just as interested in food. I mean, that obsession, they maybe want a little wider variety. You know, noticing there's a couple of new Thai restaurants and they're just getting mobbed. There's one in Chalmette called Secret Thai Restaurant. It's not a secret anymore. no, but it's fabulous. Although sometimes you have to wait a while for your food. There's a brand new vendor in the auction house market called Long Chim, if I'm remembering correctly. I've gone for the past 2 days. It's fabulous, and they've been slammed as well. So. You know, and there's this brand new Chinese restaurant in the French Quarter.
We have a dim sum place right
down
the street.
And they're so slammed they had to stop doing lunch. So I don't know if those are people who have been here forever or newcomers, but the excitement for some of these foods that, you know, we've always had great Vietnamese, Italian, things like that. But clearly there's this real strong demand for some things that we haven't had. And I don't know if those are the new people, or maybe we just always wanted those things and they just weren't done as well here in the city. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, there's always been a few good Thai restaurants, particularly on the West Bank, but
right. I think that's a really interesting question, Todd, because and that's why I like to ask that question. We, you know, Vietnamese food's been here for the past couple decades, and very
since 75,
and very strongly, right? And you know, we see, for example, the Mexican food has not been well represented here,
right.
Beyond a certain level, like the higher level of Mexican cuisine, we're starting to see trickle in here,
yeah.
It is a city based on tradition, but then there's a city. I mean, people think we're also maybe averse to change, and I don't think so either.
I think if it's good, it's embraced.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Catalino's, this Guatemalan restaurant on Maple Street, seems to be very popular. People talk about it all the time. It's excellent. It's something we really haven't had. It's a new cuisine, more or less. And people seem to enjoy it and embrace it because it's really good. So I think if it's quality, it will get embraced. I don't think we're averse to change so much as We have really high standards.
I like that. We have really, really high standards. That's really good. And you're going to stick around for another shot with Noel Drinks when we do the podcast thing, which we'll get to in a second. Let me ask you this question, since we're kind of on this topic. I always find it interesting where, as listeners know, I grew up in the Bay Area by Oakland. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up around a lot of Asian cuisine and things like that. Mm-hmm. And when we start to look at something like where we now have a sizable Mexican population here in New Orleans, but things like, say, Japanese food, for example, we don't have a big Japanese population in New Orleans.
Right.
So what is sometimes the vector, do you think, to introduce new cuisines? Like you said, if it's good, mm-hmm. that's great. But sometimes the introduction can be a little hard if we don't have that indigenous population to actually bring it in.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you've got to have that, I think. And
we're seeing that in Kennermore, right, for example?
We're seeing in Kennermore. You know, there's a great flea market in Harvey that has a huge range of Latin American vendors doing great stuff.
Yep.
It's, you know, Cuban and Guatemalan and Colombian, and it's just great. It's so much fun. Mm-hmm. And that's on the weekends. And that's part of, I think those are newer residents. I think that's a post-Katrina, our Latin population has risen. And I think, you know, those people, in a while, they'll have success at that market, and they'll get a little more money, and they'll open some maybe, you know, full restaurant.
So they're more downtown.
Yeah, and it'd be a little higher profile. And I think that's the way it works. I mean, I think bit by bit, most of the time, they just kind of move in. So I think we're going to see more Latin American cuisine. I think those vendors who are doing great food at, like, the Harvey Flea Market, I think that's the next thing you're going to see. Like,
okay, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty exciting. So, and actually, because this is what I want to, when we do the podcast only portion here, come up in a second, this is what I want to kind of get into, is what some of the things that you're excited about coming up here. And I think, like we were talking about there on the West Bank, like Saffron's a good example, right? And people bringing cuisine, starting in the environs of New Orleans and then bringing it around
here. Well, and that's this dim sum restaurant in the French Quarter. They had a Chinese restaurant in Kenner. There goes the fork.
Yep, there it goes. I'm gesticulating, and I flicked a fork away from the pork belly. Well, on that note, here's what we're going to do, friends. We're going to close out the radio portion of the show before I make Todd lose an eye here. And Todd's going to stick around for another shot with Noel Drinks. Friends, so remember, be kind to one another, use your turn signal, and until then, cheers, y'all. Thanks, everybody, for sticking around for another shot with Noel Drinks, brought to you by our good friends at Top Taco and New Orleans Agave Week coming up in March. Yeah, all kinds of great events surrounding Top Taco and Agave Week. Go check out NolaAgaveWeek.com and TopTacoNola.com for tickets and more information. We'll be out there. We're going to be doing some shows. We're going to be having some fun. I think I'm a cocktail judge at Top Taco again, so come tell me what your thoughts are about some of the cocktails that you taste as I'm walking around with a clipboard and a glass. It's always a good time, actually. A lot of fun. Hey, yeah, so I hope you enjoy this conversation that we're having here with Todd Price, lead dining writer from NOLA.com and the Times-Picayune newspaper. We're going to bounce right back over to Two Jags, where we tape the interview and continue our conversation with Todd. Also, nice of the newish executive chef there, Thomas Roby, to parachute in and bring us a couple delicious plates of food and talk a little bit about his background and taking over the reins there at Two Jags. So, yeah, we're going to bounce back over, chat a little bit more with Todd, and then I'll be back with my parting shot. Here we go. right, everybody. Yep. Another shot with Noel Drinks. Thanks for listening in here, friends. We are Two Jags chatting with Todd Price, who is the lead dining writer for NOLA.com and the Times-Picayune. Hey, we're talking about, Todd, we're talking about, you know, Two Jags being the second oldest restaurant in New Orleans from 1856. The newspaper that you work for has been around for a while.
Yeah, yeah. wow, it's 180
things have changed recently, or something.
Yeah, yeah. We've been here almost as long.
So. and in this world of digital that yep. I think that we find, man, I'm going to get into some things that you're excited about here
yeah.
on the landscape, but how has that changed for you, man, just as a journalist and doing what you're doing? As you know, we've had an abrupt change in the past 10 or so years as yeah. it relates to social media and the way people get information.
Well, I mean, in my case, I came from that, you know. I mean, I only got into journalism kind of as a second career. I was 30 when I started freelancing. I was okay. 40 when I got a staff job at the Times-Picayune. Although I've been writing for them for 5 years as a freelancer. But for me, I mean, you know, when I was finishing grad school, I started a blog because I knew I wrote like an academic. So I started a blog and did that, and I did social media. So for me, it's not unusual for me. I mean, I'm lucky that I kind of came to it all by the point that this environment had kind of started coming into focus. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, I mean, it's been a dramatic shift, and I think people kind of downplay how hard, I mean, we talked about shifting the culture of restaurants, shifting the culture of a newspaper, an institution, going from end of the day deadlines to the deadlines. You know, people say, when's your deadline? It's right now and as early as possible. Like that's, yeah, you know, that's yeah. the way it runs now. It's, there's no end of the day, this or that. It's get it up, do it, go around the clock. I mean, we've always staffed around the clock, but we publish around the clock. We have night editors and reporters who are up all night. We're on the weekends. So it's a different atmosphere. It's a different rhythm. I enjoy it, though. It keeps you energized.
It keeps, so. Right. And you're, as you're talking about, you're publishing things it's not dependent on getting that deadline out
right.
for the morning paper. I was an editor of my, was the music editor for my university paper uh-huh. way back when. So using light tables and X-Acto knives and these sorts of things. And then we all had to rotate through. Two of us had to be on at night to finish up the
sure.
the production and then drive it to the place north of San Diego to actually get it printed at 2 or 3 in the morning, so it would be on the campus doorstep in the morning at 6 or 7 o'clock. And that doesn't, yeah. I think we started to use PageMaker a little bit.
Right.
Well, and so when you did, so Spanish, your PhD is in Spanish language or lit?
Literature.
Yeah. Okay.
So. 17th century theater, actually.
17th century theater. Okay, cool.
Which was incredibly useful when I came to New Orleans, actually.
And it's super like great to like look at Latin languages because they're all pretty much the same,
aren't
they?
Right, that's right.
So where did you live in Spain, Todd?
So I lived in Salamanca when I was an undergraduate. Okay. Spent a lot of time in Madrid in grad school. Lived a year in France after college teaching English.
Whereabouts?
In the north, in Lille, which is just 6 miles from the Belgian border.
Sure.
Beer-drinking region. Yep. Not a wine region.
Not a wine region, right.
But I taught English at a university there for a year after I graduated from college.
Cool. So what are some of the things that you're pretty excited about coming up here in New Orleans? We started to kind of get into
yeah.
this as far as, you know, changing trends. I think we're seeing more ethnic food coming in that's actually well done instead of sort of phoning it in.
Yeah.
Like not, well, I shouldn't say strip mall stuff because there's a lot of good stuff in strip malls.
There is. Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, if nothing else, geographically, we're seeing it in Orleans Parish. Not there hasn't been some, but I mean, you know, first we finally saw the Vietnamese kind of come into Orleans Parish. They didn't have to go to the New Orleans East or West Bank. And now we're seeing dim sum and more Latin American cuisine. So I think that's part of it is moving in. You know, it's interesting. There's a lot of classic French. Couvent, I think, is one of my favorite new restaurants. Straight ahead French. Brad McDonald's the chef.
Yeah.
Incredibly talented. And then Justin Devilliers, we were talking Open Justine. Mm-hmm. Again, pretty straight ahead French. Mm-hmm. Old school, a lot of French drinks on the menu too. I was really excited
oh,
when
cool.
I went
okay.
in. They yeah. had a dry kind of funky cider on tap. And they had Bière Picon, which is beer with Amer Picon, which is I don't know what they're using because Picon is, as far as I know, you can't get it in the U.S. There's some substitutes, but it's an orange kind of bitter liqueur. And in France, they pour it with their beer.
Maybe Pierre France, like dry carrots.
Probably, yeah. Well, like no, it's a little different. There is a substitute, and I'm forgetting
oh,
the name.
Okay.
You can get it at Keith and Company.
Go ask John. Okay,
that's right. It's not pecan, but it's just like it. But it's an orange sort of bitter liqueur. You pour it in beer. But no, it was fun to see them having some of these French drinks that you just don't see anywhere else in this town. So, but that's been fun. Yeah. And of course, I'm very excited about the new place that Nick Dietrich and Chris Hanna are opening. Yeah.
The Jewel of the South there on
Jewel
St. Louis.
Jewel of the South. Yep. I mean, Chris Hanna is just one of the best bartenders in the city. Consummate. Yeah. Hospitality.
I'm going to go with one of the best bartenders in the country, if not
on the planet. The city is selling him short. You know, it goes beyond that. Yeah, so it's great that he's actually has some ownership in a place, and I'm really excited to see what he's going to do with that. So.
Yeah, that's good. And those two guys get the hospitality thing here pretty well, I think. And so it's going to be an interesting space. I think they're pretty close to opening, if I understand correctly.
That's what I hear.
Yeah, so we'll see that. And anything else? I mean, what are you, this sort of landscape-wise, are you seeing some trends coming up here 2019 to kind of look for? And I'm kind of putting you on the spot. But
I have to say, I'm not good at predicting trends. It's not the way my mind thinks.
Fair enough.
I mean,
any other exciting opening? Let me ask you this, because I think we've seen some things like, say, for example, in the Bywater in Marigny,
sure,
where people have tried some really interesting concepts.
Yeah, hasn't always worked.
Have not flown.
No, the Bywater's been tough.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I think we know with a little bit of the short-term rental stuff and things like that, and I'm oversimplifying about how that works, but we talked about needing regulars that come in that keep you alive during the summer, for example, and I know it's been a tough sell in that neighborhood, but I think we did see going back 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, really any time after post-Katrina up until recently, that you could be on Aretha Castle Haley, you could be in the Bywater, you could be on St. Claude and do okay. And it seems that there's kind of been a little bit of a retrenching back towards Uptown and French Quarter, of places that are seemingly more viable.
I think so. I think the exception is Mid-City, Lakeview. I think people are doing well over there. But there is a lot of vacant real estate around town. Not a ton, but you'd look, the old Maurepas Foods place, the old, what's the one across from?
Oh, there's like Booty's right there was there.
Well, no, yeah, right. And that's now Paloma Cafe, which seems to be doing really well. Yeah. But I'm forgetting the name of the place.
Oh, Oxalis was right there.
Oxalis, thank you. Yeah. And they're both still sitting empty, which is surprising.
Yeah.
But I do find, I mean, it does seem like there's still a lot of interest in Mid-City. That's still residential. I mean, that's where a lot of people live, and it's still, I think, underserved. I live pretty close over there. I live over by City Park, and we still don't have as many options. I think Lakeview, people are still doing well. But you're right. I mean, I think there is a retrenchment to some of the main areas geographically in the city. So,
what about Lakeview, since you're kind of out in that direction? So,
I can tell you, from writing about it, anytime I write about a restaurant in Lakeview, like the amount of people who read those stories is insane. So clearly, to me, that tells me there's a real pent-up desire in Lakeview for more places. People are really excited when anything opens in Lakeview.
Okay. So. Burger joints.
Burger joints, casual, burger joints. Sports bars, 3B. Yeah, it doesn't really matter what it is. If it's in Lakeview, there's going to be a lot of people reading that.
Yeah, so, right on. Yeah. Well, Todd, do me a favor. Tell people where they can actually connect with you online, where they find your writing and the stuff that you do.
So the easiest way to find us is just go to nola.com/where Nola eats. And that's sort of the catch-all for all of our coverage. You can go to the Facebook. We've got a really active group with about 46,000 members. Also, Where Nola Eats. We're on Instagram. We're on all the places.
You're on all the places. And then you can also, you know, if it's really your bent, and maybe it should be, you can subscribe to the newspaper.
You can. You can get it in print. Support local journalism. We're all in favor of that.
So. Awesome. We need to be able to, you know, keep Todd paying his bar bill and his restaurant bill when he goes out.
Somebody's got to pay my expenses.
Thanks, Todd. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much. Friends, we're going to take a brief musical interlude here, and I'll be back with my parting shot. All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening into the show this week. As always, friends, as I noted at the top of the show, next week's installment will be another episode of our French Quarter Fest series. This time, we're going to be chatting with Corey Henry, who is the band leader for Corey Henry and the Tremé Funktet. The gentleman grew up in the Tremé, has an incredible musical background, including playing in the Tremé Brass Band, all kinds of other stuff. Really interesting guy, super nice guy, as well as Sam Kraft, also another interesting and nice fella. He is in the band Sweet Crude, the bilingual French and English indie pop influence South Louisiana band. There you go. And we are over at Louisiana Music Factory, as we always are, with that interview. So that's what we'll have going on for you next week. Friends, it's our parting shot.
You know, it's something I was just kind of thinking about that came out in the news about a week ago, maybe a little bit more than a week ago, that the defensive lineman for the New Orleans Saints, Daniel Onyemata, who really helped save the Saints seasons defensively in a lot of ways because of injuries, things like that, filling in and being a very effective player. Well, he was busted for marijuana in his apartment in the Elmwood River Ridge area, which is in Jefferson Parish, just outside of New Orleans. And it was a misdemeanor citation. He was not arrested. It was apparently very, very cooperative. It was a relatively small amount of marijuana products found in his apartment. The Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office got a tip that there was going to be some marijuana going on in his apartment. And what that tip was, it was actually a flagged package from U.S. Customs. I guess the package sounds like maybe came from Canada because it was flagged in Buffalo, New York. All right. Well, you know, it's one of those things that I do struggle with this. I think a lot of people, and let me back up here, because Onyemata's, there was never any sort of implication that he was going to be selling anything. It was only for personal use, all that good stuff. But I do struggle with this. A lot of people, and NFL players in particular, advocate for the use of medicinal marijuana due to pain management. It's very effective when it comes to managing pain and as well as any number of other ailments. We know it can be an appetite stimulant for those who, for example, are on chemotherapy or who have AIDS. It's good for glaucoma. It's good for anxiety, all kinds of different things. But I think maybe probably what we're talking about here is pain management. And I think we know anybody who would argue that, that it's worse than opioids. And we have an opioid epidemic in this country. Okay. It's a significant problem, the addiction problem, but also the big pharmaceutical companies and how this all operates, prescriptions. And we're not going too far down that road here, but it's a radical problem. And marijuana is a potential, not a complete solution, but marijuana is a potential benefit. It's a potential thing that may contribute to chipping away at the opioid crisis and use that we have in this country. Another thing is that we see in particular parts of the country that have legalized, fully legalized medical marijuana or even recreational marijuana, that it's good for local economies. There was an article out in Forbes in December, not too long ago, December 18, of course. And they were talking about, for example, every midterm, every election cycle, more states legalize marijuana in some fashion or another. Maybe it's the relaxing of laws, it's the legalization of medical marijuana, or the legalization of recreational use. This past go-around in the midterm elections, Michigan became the 10th state to legalize recreational use. Utah and Missouri became the 32nd and 33rd states, respectively, to legalize medical marijuana use. They make the argument and they point to a lot of facts that the rising green tide, as it's called, promises new streams of tax revenue and job growth. For example, Michigan, that I just mentioned, where, again, recreational cannabis was just made legal, it's going to be taxed at 10%. That's a big number. But we won't go too far down the black market and what pricing is and all that stuff. Conversation for another time. But taxing anything, 10%, that's a lot of money. The state estimates that it will generate $737.9 million in additional tax revenue in the first 4 years after legalization. That is enough to meet the budget for the state's police force for an entire year, or plug its shortfall in its funding for special education. We also see, for example, in Nevada, that Nevada is pouring $42.5 million in taxes, far exceeding their original predictions from their latest fiscal year, into its rainy day fund, which was almost completely dry. Colorado and Washington, which were, of course, the first two states to legalize recreational use, collected nearly $250 million and $320 million, respectively, in cannabis-related taxes and fees in 2017 alone. Let's look at Massachusetts. They're looking, I guess, to legalize recreational cannabis, and that's their forecast. I'm not sure, forgive me, I'm not sure where things stand legally there, but they're estimating that will generate $216 million in the first 2 years. Actually, I guess it is legal. So since the state's first cannabis shop sold more than $2.2 million worth of products during the first 5 days of sales, this does not appear to be blind optimism, as the article cites. We also want to talk about jobs. For example, the U.S. cannabis industry is generating new jobs.
There have already been 80,000 new jobs created in California because of cannabis sales, and that's producing a $3.5 billion increase in labor income, according to a study by ICF International. University of Illinois has found that the taxation and regulation of cannabis could create nearly 24,000 new jobs and generate over $500 million in new revenue for that state. The entire cannabis industry has the potential to create more than 300,000 new jobs by 2020. So this is what I want to talk about. It's good for local economies. Now, I think we have some issues here where we have big pharmaceutical companies. Remember Marinol? I don't know if anybody remembers this. I think it might still be around. It was where Big Pharma tried to isolate the major chemical compound that everybody thought was the main ingredient, active ingredient, medicinally as well as psychoactively, THC, and put it in a pill. Well, it didn't really work. Why? Because marijuana has all kinds of other chemical compounds going on that obviously, I'm no scientist, but interact in some fashion or another to make it more effective just simply as it is coming out of the ground or being grown in a greenhouse. We know that. So Big Pharma is trying to kind of corner the market, or has been. We know that alcohol companies, big liquor companies, are starting to get into the marijuana-infused drink industry. And of course, there's the big tobacco companies that want their hands all over it. It is a plant that grows from the earth, or it is a plant that can easily be grown in a greenhouse. It's something that you can grow in your own backyard, just like you would grow your own vegetables. Okay, so, you know, this whole rush to kind of corner the market by big companies and make money off it, I have a big problem with. I have a big problem with the fact that something that is a natural product like this is illegal. And then I have this a big problem with, I think legalization of it recreationally is great. I think legalization of it for medicinal marijuana is great. But it's a plant that grows from the earth. Okay, now let's talk about Daniel Onyemata again. He might be actually suspended for up to 4 games. Now, in the NFL, first time testing positive is usually just a warning, apparently, but possession is a different story, so we need to kind of figure that out. We know we have a lot of retired NFL players suffering from chronic injuries. Marijuana is something that may actually help with this. The NFL needs to rectify this. We have all kinds of states now where there are teams, NFL teams, that operate where marijuana is legal, or medical marijuana and or recreational marijuana is legal. The NFL needs to address this. I think Louisiana, our state where we are right here, needs to address it. All those numbers that I just gave you, we all know about the budget shortfalls here and things like that. Hey, you know, could be pretty helpful for our economy, right? And I think culturally we need to address this. I think we all know that it, you know, marijuana is no worse than alcohol, and it is far, far better than tobacco. And we certainly know, back to the tobacco thing, we know how the big tobacco companies handled things with cigarettes and minors and cancer and all that other stuff in times past. Do we really want these big companies controlling something that is a natural remedy? I don't really know. It is kind of hard for us to know, of course, because marijuana federally continues to be listed as a Schedule I drug, you know, up there with heroin and everything else. So it's incredibly difficult to be able to study and come up with any sort of positive conclusions. Generally, if you're going to get funding to study from the federal government, you're going to have to come out and say, our study is designed to show how bad it is. Now, obviously, on the state level, things are changing. We're seeing studies actually showing the benefits of medicinal marijuana. And, you know, so that tide is kind of changing. But on a federal level, that needs to change. We need to have an open and honest dialogue about what this stuff is and how it fits into society, how it fits recreationally, how it fits medicinally, all that stuff. Here in Louisiana, the only place that you can study, my understanding, there's only one entity, LSU, that is allowed to actually study it. I think that's pretty short-sighted. Look, I think it's something that really, really needs to change. It's financially beneficial. It's a natural remedy that grows from the earth. It's good pain management, all that good stuff. On Onyemata, again, just one last thing. The Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office has not decided whether they're going to charge Onyemata or not. And for all kinds of reasons, I really hope they don't. Friends, that's our parting shot. Here's to you.